Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have a fascinating and extra special guest. David Snyderman has put together an incredible career in fixed income, alternative credit, and really just an amazing way of looking at risk and trade structure and how to figure out probabilistic potential outcomes rather than playing the usual forecasting and macro tourist game. He is global head of alt credit and fixed income and managing partner at Magnetar. They have an incredible track record. They've put together a string of huge, huge returns. They are not like any other fund that you'll hear me talk about. They're pretty unique and specific in the world. I found this conversation to be fascinating. And even though we kind of wander off into the weeds of private credit, it's so informative and so interesting. I think you'll really enjoy it. With no further ado, my discussion with Magnetar's David Snyderman.
Thank you very much for having me, Barry. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
I am also. I'm very familiar with Magnetar and its history. It's really a fascinating firm in so many ways. Let's start, though, talking a little bit about your background. You grow up in suburban New Jersey, and then you head to St. Louis for college. Tell us a little bit about where you went and what you studied.
Sure. I grew up in Freehold, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So most people know, home of Bruce Springsteen. You know, my focus coming out of high school was playing football. I wanted to play football
really?
At the highest level I could.
You are not much bigger than me. What made you think you could play on the gridiron?
I don't know why I thought I could, but I definitely thought I could at the time. And so I wanted to play at the highest level possible. My parents were much more focused on an academic institution, and so WashU sort of met both criteria.
Did you play ball in college?
I did, all 4 years. It was a lot of fun.
What position did you play?
I played strong safety. And yeah, Division III was the highest level I could play at, but I loved it.
Right. So safety, you have to be pretty fast.
That was the issue.
So, but for that, you would have gone pro.
There you go.
What did you study at WashU?
WashU back then was, they had a great medical school, and they still do today. And in my family, being a doctor was the highest level of achievement. Mm-hmm. So I had an older sister starting medical school, and I had a relative that's actually the dean of Duke Medical School. So I had this nice glide path to be a doctor.
Right.
So I started off pre-med. But I didn't end pre-med. I found out quickly that's not what I wanted to do. The hardest part was telling my parents, and especially my grandparents, you know, no more pre-med. So I switched to be an economics major. I graduated economics with a lot of coursework in accounting and finance.
Huh. Interesting. So you come out of college, you go to PricewaterhouseCoopers and then Koch Industries, where you're focusing on convertible securities, merger arb, and special situations. How do you get from medical school to that? What was the career plan?
Yeah, my path was certainly non-traditional. I didn't go to one of the East Coast Ivy League schools knowing I wanted to go to Wall Street. I didn't even know what work on Wall Street meant at the time. So for me, it was much more around, you know, being around fantastic people and really taking advantage of opportunities. So like you said, I started at Price Waterhouse and I went through a one-year rotation there. So it started with audit, so I saw many companies, then tax, then financial services. So it was a great training ground to understand how, you know, theoretics went into the practical business. From there, I went to Koch Industries and I had a great experience at Koch. I was there 5 years. I worked in three different places for them. So I started in Houston, Texas, and I worked on their natural gas business. Then this opportunity came up in Switzerland. So it's a 13,000 person company, and there were going to be five people in Switzerland to manage about several hundred million dollars, more in cash optimization. So I had the opportunity to be a junior person there. I'd never left the US before. Uh-huh. So I was sat in the middle of Switzerland and sat there for 2 years and worked in that business, and then went to Wichita, Kansas. Wichita, Kansas was the home office. And there were sort of a dozen of us, very similarly situated, you know, all young and hungry, but they had great management at Koch. They really encouraged us to start businesses. So I remember writing the merger our business plan there, mm-hmm. right, and then implementing the business. So a quick fun fact about Koch. At Magnetar today, we have three of my prior bosses that, you know, from Koch. So it's pretty neat. But to answer your question, like, I had a lot of broad experiences by the time I was in my mid-20s, but no real direction on what my career was going to be.
Where in Switzerland? Was it Geneva or somewhere else?
It was Fribourg, so a town 20 minutes from Bern. It was a tax-free canton.
Uh-huh.
So I was in a town that spoke, you know, half French and half German, and I spoke English. So
there you go. But no taxes, no income taxes.
No income taxes for the company.
And then Koch Industries, I don't think a lot of people realize, one of the largest private companies in the United States, and maybe even the largest. They're giant. Energy powerhouse. What else does Koch do?
Yeah, so when I was there, they had 13,000 people, and that was before they bought Georgia Pacific. I think now it's probably 35,000 people.
Immense.
It's immense. And so they have many, many different business lines there. For me, I sat mostly in their internal hedge fund. So it was their excess cash. They borrowed money at live bid at the time. So they borrowed money very cheaply. And our job was to make money on that money.
So you end up as head of global credit and senior managing director at Citadel Investment Group. Was that right from Koch Industries?
That was.
7 years at Citadel. That's supposed to be a tough shop to work at. What was your experience like there?
It was the perfect job for me at the time. So I always thought I worked at a high level of intensity.
Right.
Right. But when I got there, I realized I was one of many.
Right.
But I had the opportunity to work for a gentleman, Dave Bunning. He was one of the original few handful of people that started at Citadel. And Dave was fantastic in so many different ways. A great leader, a great investor, but really a great person. And he took me under his wing there. It was a lot of work, but a lot of formidable lessons came out of my time there. Right. So the first one that I think about is the investing business itself is an operating business. So we really have to understand what we're going to invest in, value everything in the universe, mm-hmm. rank order them, and then only can we put together portfolios. And the second, and this is very credit specific, was when you own a credit portfolio, you're short volatility. So what that simply means is if you have a dislocation, you're going to lose a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
And so to put together credit portfolios, we have to find hedges that offset that short volatility. So really learning the value of options, right, was probably the biggest lesson coming out of Citadel.
So I want to rephrase that for some of the less option and vol savvy members of the audience. When we buy fixed income, we just want it to be steady and pay a dividend and not swing up and down. And if it does swing up and down, the odds are it's not in your favor. That volatility you can look at as an insurance product. If the volatility goes up, hey, we can make a bet that will offset the drawdown in the bonds.
That's exactly right.
All right. And you at Citadel, you were running a convertible bond and credit trading desk. Is that what you eventually ended up as, head of global credit?
That's correct. I started there on the convertible bond arbitrage desk, and then we started capital structure arbitrage, which meant we were, you know, buying or selling credit and against that, buying and selling equities. And finally, we consolidated that together, and I ran that business for Ken and Citadel.
And some of the folks, Ken being Ken Griffin, when people say Citadel is a lot of work, you don't realize there's a whole nother gear you have to move into, and it's next level. Was that your experience?
It was, and for me, I actually loved that part of Citadel. It was 16-hour days, and it was 6 or 7 days a week, but you really got to learn the financial markets there.
Huh, interesting. So Magnetar launches in 2005 with some capital. And you joined, you weren't one of the original founders, but you joined not long afterwards.
That's correct. So Alec Litowitz and Ross Lazar founded the firm. And, you know, I did join the day we launched our main fund. Now, for me, Alec was a known quantity. He ran equities at Citadel with Dave Bunning, my prior boss there. And then when I moved up into Dave's spot, Alec moved out and they started. And he spent, I think, 2 years on a non-compete and then started Magnetar. Him and Ross Lazar co-founded the firm, and they had a vision to co-found the firm. And I bought into the vision immediately. And Alec always did a great job of laying it out, right? And first was, we're going to have a culture of collaboration. So back then, you probably remember in 2005, you know, there were a lot of what they called pod shops. So they'd give individual asset allocation to people and they'd go invest their money. This was going to be a multi-strategy vehicle. So we'd have credit, we'd have equities, we'd have hedge fund strategies, but with no silos. So we're going to work together and put best opportunities into the portfolio.
So you have people from Koch Industries with you. You have people from Citadel. Did those prior employees have a piece of you guys? Did they seed you? Did they invest you? Or was it just a clean break and we're off on our own?
It was a clean break. And Ross Lazar came from the fund of funds world. And he was the primary money raiser and business builder there. And so he did a fantastic job. I think we're the largest launch of 2005 with about $2.3 billion.
How long did it take you to get up and running where you felt, oh, this is really, all the pieces are in place?
Yeah, it's a good question and funny you asked that question because we talk about it often around Magnetar. You know, I started and I hired three or four people that I started with, and Ross Lazar, right? And again, he's my partner, my close friend, right? And a great business builder. 2 weeks into it, he came to me and said, what's the first investment? Like, when are you going to start investing? And I said to Ross, look, we're going to build the systems and infrastructure to prepare to invest first. And
I need a computer and an internet line and maybe a trader to help us out.
That's exactly what Ross was saying. And he very politely said to me, you know, you're here to invest, not to build software. And so I think he stopped by my desk for the next 9 months every single day and asked the same question. But it truly took us 9 months to build the systems and infrastructure just to be investment ready.
Wow, that's amazing. 9 months. And I have to ask, why Evanston in Illinois? I mean, I like Lou Malnati's and Superdog as much as the next guy, but why the middle of the Illinois suburbs, the Chicago suburbs?
Yeah, so it was just north of the city, and it's across the street from Northwestern, so that would be the draw. You know, the train lines end there, so you can recruit people from the city, but it was probably a little more selfish. Like, we all lived on the North Shore of Chicago, and so it was an easy commute for us to work, and so that's where we started the firm.
And that is really a lovely part of the world, on the lake. It's such a manageable, easy city to operate within. I mean, the winters are a little cold, but still, it's a lovely place.
It's a great quality of life in Chicago and outside of Chicago.
So only a few years later, we're right in the teeth of the great financial crisis. How did you guys navigate that?
We were very fortunate, and we performed quite well in our credit strategies, which certainly we can talk about. We had both long and short credit products. And we had a long volatility position, meaning we protected the balance sheet very well if there was a dislocation. And I think that went back to some of the prior lessons from prior firms. Like, we really need to have portfolios that we protect the balance sheet and make sure that we're able to stand up in difficult environments.
I have noticed that a lot of firms that describe themselves as hedge funds really aren't very hedged. You guys operated pretty fully hedged at most of the time, right?
We really did. And the systems and infrastructure we built were not only to measure risk, but to manage that risk. And so we'd find good investments both on the long and short side.
So even if you have a position that's long, you have an offsetting or matching position, or do you just hedge out that long position with a short bet?
So there's a quality of earnings question embedded in I think what you said, and that's, we're trying not to take macro level bets. Those for us are low quality bets. And so what we're trying to take is idiosyncratic bets, meaning we're focused on one factor and we're betting on that factor. Then we're going to hedge out all of the macro risks around the portfolio.
Huh, really interesting.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So we were talking about you guys launched a few years right before the financial crisis. I wanted to talk about a couple of trades from that era. Perhaps most famously, you guys put on a CDO bet, a collateralized debt obligation bet that was designed to do well if housing made some extreme moves, and it was non-directional, it was hedged. Tell us a little bit about the Magnetar CDO bet from the financial crisis.
I talked about setting up the infrastructure to prepare to invest, and we looked at every asset class. So we looked at corporates, we looked at mortgages, we looked at credit cards. And what we found in the mortgage market is something you don't read about in textbooks. Mm-hmm. We found that we could invest on the long side in what they call the equity piece or the most risky piece of a CDO.
Right.
And we could short the next level up, so the mezzanine piece. And we could short two or three times the amount. But what was super interesting was we were getting paid to hold an option. That never happens.
Right. Options cost you money, and that's the old joke. Option traders never die. They just expire worthless.
That's exactly right. In this case, we were going to hold an option that we were going to get paid 15 to 20% a year to hold.
Oh, really? That's real money.
So you never see that and you never read about that, but that's the way the market's set up. It was just too fragmented. You had people that were willing to buy pieces of these structured products because of the ratings, and on things that weren't rated, no one was willing to buy. So we took the other side of that trade.
So you bought the unrated portions and you shorted the rated portions.
That's correct.
Huh, that's very contrarian. That's very interesting. How did you identify that opportunity? That's such a, talk about idiosyncratic niche trades. How did you figure that out?
The firm was built on finding white spaces. And so I remember back in 2005 when we first started, you know, we'd think about the banks. The banks would have an equity trading desk and they'd have a debt desk.
Right.
And they'd both value the same companies and both sides of the firm would value them completely differently. And so for us, those are exactly the opportunities we were looking for. But we didn't find it in the corporate markets. We found it in the mortgage market. It was so fragmented that the machine that sold rated products hit all the right buyers, but no one could sell the unrated piece. The unrated piece yielded 20, 25%, where the rated piece would yield 3 to 5%. And so that difference was the arbitrage that we saw.
So heading into 2005, 2006, we saw real estate peak in, I want to say, in volume in 05 and price in 06. So if you're getting paid 15-20% to hold the unrated piece, isn't there a lot of downside risk that, hey, if some of these mortgages go south, you could see, you know, you get cut in half or worse?
That's exactly right. And so what the modeling actually said, though, is if nothing happens in the world, we make this 20% return. But if anything happened, not only would our equity piece suffer, but the short side or our mezzanine pieces would make the money back. And that's the ratio.
And then so.
That's the ratio we had to be on.
Mm-hmm.
So what they call that is delta neutral in the options world.
Right.
So we were hedging an option, and that hedge made us a lot of money in downside scenarios, but that was never the focus. We didn't know the housing market would crash. We had no idea. What we had was a trade or an investment that we'd make 20% a year on, and if anything happened in the world, we've really protected the balance sheet. It just happened quite quickly.
So let's talk a little bit about what's going on today, especially in some of the private alternative spaces. You've talked about pensions are now facing illiquidity issues because private equity and venture capital have gates up, a lot of long-term tie-ups. How has this affected your business?
Yeah, that's been the most challenging part of the business.
Really?
So it really has. And pension funds, they're on hold today. They're not investing. And it's been not just a headwind for us, but for the entire industry. So I'll step back and I'll give you my view on it. So pensions have this mandate. They have a diversified portfolio they invest in. They receive cash flow from the portfolio, and that supports their retiree benefits. So they're always making this judgment, will I produce enough cash to manage those liabilities? What happened over the last year and a half or so is rates went up and valuations went down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the handshake agreement with the venture firms and the private equity firms was give them a dollar today, and in 5 years, they'll give you back $2 or $3, right? Depending on how the fund did. They've stopped giving back that capital today.
Oh, really?
And so the pension funds are faced with this illiquidity problem. And so they're borrowing money against their portfolios. They're selling positions in their portfolios. But what they're not doing isn't taking on new investments. Now, there's a flip side to this. Whenever we have trouble raising capital, the investment opportunities are usually very good.
Right.
So our pipeline is extremely robust today.
Huh. That's really intriguing. Do you see this across the board, or is it really just more generalized that when you have the dislocation of 500 plus basis points in 18 months, what does that do to the landscape?
It always changes the landscape. And so no one's ever prepared for moves of that size, even though everyone says they are. And so it's opportunities that have come out of this mainly are around the banks today, right? And so we can talk a little bit more about that.
Well, let's talk a bit about Magnetar has more of a specialty finance focus than other credit managers. Tell us about that and how has the shift in rates impacted specialty finance?
Yeah, so after the GFC, these private credit markets really developed, and they went in two different directions. They went in direct lending, right? And so 90% of the market went direct lending.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to middle market companies and disintermediating the banks and lending directly to them. For us, we went in a different direction. We went in specialty finance. And specialty finance is a bit smaller, but it's been around for ages and it touches our lives every day.
Define it if you would.
Yeah, so it's the cars we drive, so auto loans. It's the houses we buy or rent, so it's mortgages. It's the podcasts that we stream, right? So it's all the music royalties and streaming royalties. So it's assets like that. And the interesting part about these assets is there's a very strong investment thesis around them because they have three attributes when combined together that most other asset classes don't have, and certainly I don't think direct lending has. So the first is you can find very stable payoff profiles.
Uh-huh.
Second, you can find assets or these payoff profiles that don't correlate to the overall market. So you're not worried about them moving with the S&P or the high yield index, right? And third, and most importantly, they don't correlate to one another. And so I'll give you an example of a three asset portfolio. So in our music royalty portfolio, returns could be driven by an artist's song downloads, like Taylor Swift downloads. And in our solar finance portfolio, it's by how much sunlight there is in a particular region. Or lately, we've been lending a lot against NVIDIA GPUs for cloud usage, and that's driven by AI and machine learning growth. If I think about just those three assets, they shouldn't correlate to the S&P, but they certainly shouldn't correlate to one another.
Huh.
That's how we can really produce a high quality of earnings for our investors.
Huh. Really interesting. You mentioned banks earlier. I know that Magnetar has had opportunities to partner with banks via what some people call reg cap transactions. Tell us a little bit about those.
So reg cap, or some people call them significant risk transfer transactions, that is a massive opportunity for credit funds today. And so a lot of people would think that the banks are selling assets, right? But in our experience, we're seeing them efficiently transfer the credit risk of assets, but keeping the customer relationship. It's a very important distinction.
How do you do that? Either you have the asset and the credit risk, I would imagine, or if you don't, if it's a mortgage, you sell the mortgage and you're out. How do you have, how are you a little bit pregnant?
Exactly. So the solution to that are these regulatory capital solutions. And so you're taking a portfolio of credit risk and you're transferring that credit risk to a private credit fund like us, but maintaining the customer relationship. And what banks, I think, eminently realize is the customer relationship is how they drive revenues. So traditional banking, FX, advisory services, you know, high net worth. And so without that, they start to lose their franchise. This is the product that allows them to transfer credit risk. And for private credit firms, we all of a sudden have access to some of their highest quality lending. Right, it's been the fastest growing part of our portfolio.
So I'm trying to figure out if they're transferring the credit risk to you. I'm assuming you're taking some sort of contract with the bank that you're going to assume the liability if X happens, and then you, with your expertise, are hedging out that risk through your options or credit desk.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. But importantly, the first thing we're doing is we're using data to really understand what the credit risk is. And with that data, then we can start thinking about what the likely hedges are for the macro risk of the portfolio.
So let's talk about that. What is your approach to data? How do you institutionalize data management? And how do you leverage the idea of, hey, we know a lot about this. Here's how we monetize it.
People talk a lot about the importance of data, but it's usually in a different context. It's usually for these quantitative strategies or quantitative hedge funds.
Right.
For us, data is the lifeblood of specialty finance. So for us, we use data to solidify our assumptions. What we do with the data is we forecast the performance of assets by matching statistically significant characteristics. So back to the reg cap examples, we've looked at hundreds and hundreds of these types of investments, and we've taken all the data from those transactions. Now when we look at a new transaction, a bank comes to us and says, I need to produce more regulatory capital on this 100 to 10,000 loans. We can take the characteristics of their portfolio today and out of sample price them through history. Mm-hmm. That helps us price the credit, right, and understand what risk we're taking on.
So this is really fairly sophisticated financial engineering that is, it sounds like it's a way for the banks to meet the SEC requirements, the increased post-financial crisis financial reserves that they're required to have, but not have to sell off big parts of the business and not have to sell off the relationships you described.
I think that's exactly right. And even when you get to what happened earlier in 2023 with Credit Suisse, that again put pressure on the banks to really think about how they're going to hedge their credit risk. This is their hedge to credit risk.
And then related to the way you guys work with data management, tell us a little bit about Magnetar Labs.
Yeah, Magnetar Labs has been a great initiative for us. It's really the institutionalization of our data. So we're trying to produce infrastructure where we can ingest large data sets very quickly and not only use them in specific business lines, but use it across business lines. So I'll give you a few examples. In our merger arbitrage business, we've tracked every detail and every characteristic of every merger and acquisition for the last 20 plus years.
Wow.
And even our recent restaurant finance business, we have itemized bills of every customer. This is really useful data. So here's an example from just a couple of months ago. We were looking at an auto loan transaction, and the servicer tried to overload information. So they gave us 80 million line items of information.
On purpose or?
I don't know if it's on purpose or not, but 80 million line items, 100 different files, you know, 40 gigabytes of memory. So that's far too much for like Excel to handle or any local Python.
Right.
Right. It overloaded any one machine. But our Magnetar Labs team was able to take that in just minutes. Right now we can analyze the data and then look at the attributes to that investment and see if it fits in our portfolio. We actually made the investment.
So what sort of hardware are you using? Is this all cloud-based? Is this I think of like, sounds like a mainframe. I don't even know if mainframes still exist anymore.
Everything's gone to the cloud now.
Right.
I mean, it is pretty amazing.
And that sort of distributed computer has no ceiling, essentially no capacity.
Correct.
Infinite capacity.
Correct.
Huh, really, really interesting.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So let's talk a little bit about the status quo. I read something where you said it was important to not maintain the status quo. Explain what that means.
We're not efficient market theorists, but we certainly believe that in the medium to long term, the markets are efficient.
Kind of mostly eventually efficient.
Eventually efficient, right? So we know that what works today may not work several years forward,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I'll give you the converts example. Like you mentioned, I've been in the convert market for 30 years now. And sometimes converts are very cheap, you know, convertible bond arbitrage. And when they are, we have a lot of our portfolio in it. But today we have less than 1% of our portfolio in the asset class. And it's just because it's not cheap or not cheap enough versus what we can invest in.
And is the expectation is that whatever inefficiencies were there, the market's figured it out, it's arbitraged it away, and the odds are against that ever becoming really cheap, or might it, you know, become a trade again?
Yeah, some of it's supply-demand, mm-hmm. right, and driven. But I think the most important part is we're not hiring desks of people to stay in an asset class.
Uh-huh.
That's the status quo. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking to aggressively rotate our capital to get to the optimal portfolio, to get to the best risk-adjusted return.
So does this mean you're exploring new business areas and strategies, or is it just that you're rolling through the various other opportunities that you've fished in before?
Yeah, it's a good question. We maintain our diligence on other strategies, but we always have a strong research and development pipeline.
Huh, really interesting. So let's talk about some of the things that are going on today. Artificial intelligence, AI, dominated the 2023 narrative. You made investments in CoreWeave, a specialized cloud provider. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing in that space. Is that related at all to what we talked about earlier with Magnetar Labs?
Yeah, CoreWeave is such an exciting story for Magnetar. I can't say enough good things about it. Sometimes the stars just align. You have the right time, the right product, the right team. And for the listeners that don't know who CoreWeave is, CoreWeave is the largest owner of GPUs outside of the hyperscalers like Google or Amazon Web Services. They sell is high-performance compute, which is sort of the picks and shovels to enable AI. Mm-hmm. So if you are a new, you know, AI lab, you need somebody like CoreWeave to host that specialized cloud for you. Now, we were the first institutional investor, so all the way back in 2020. And at that point, CoreWeave had just $26 million of top-line revenue. And I think we were the first firm to really get comfortable lending against that asset called high-performance compute. Mm-hmm. Right. So they've had explosive growth. But what we haven't been is just a capital provider. We've really been a partner to them within the business.
Are you guys also a customer of theirs?
We're a customer of theirs in Magnetar Labs, just like you intimated before. And so we use them for Magnetar Labs. But we have Ernie Rogers, our COO, sits on their board. We have daily interaction between our management teams. This company is growing so quickly, right? They need all the help they can get around them. And what we try to help with is mostly balance sheet management.
So for a firm that specializes in credit, this almost sounds like a venture investment.
There are parts of this that are venture-ish, but what's interesting is the underlying asset, this high-performance compute, is something that we can really scale with. And so I think that's been the innovation in the marketplace. So you mentioned in 2023 on the venture side, we actually led a round for them, a $400 million Series B round, but we also led a $2.3 billion financing on their high performance compute assets.
So it's capital and credit. It's equity and credit.
It's equity and credit, and it's a true partnership between the firms. You know, towards the end of last year, you know, in December, the firm got valued at $7 billion. And
wow.
To me, it's just a start. This company you're just going to see it continue to grow over time.
Well, let me know about the C round when that comes.
For sure.
What are you guys, in all seriousness, what are you guys looking for? What sort of characteristics are you looking for when a company like this comes along? You mentioned idiosyncratic types of investment. This sounds very specific and not all that usual.
It is. It's very specific, but we always start with the assets. So it's assets, it's data, and it's structure. Right. So first on the assets, we're usually focused on specialty finance because the assets drive the performance of the company.
Uh-huh.
Right. The next thing we need is data. We can't predict the future. So what we're trying to do is use historical data to predict how an asset reacts in different states of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we use structure around that to protect the downside of the investment itself.
Huh. Sounds really intriguing. So as long as we're talking about 2023, we saw a lot of bank failures last year. We saw, you know, the response to a rapid increase in rates. You had a front row seat to what transpired. Share what that was like and what did you guys see in the space? Tell us about the opportunities that came up from those events.
Those were stressful events for the entire community. You know, for Silicon Valley Bank in particular, I remember it was Friday night and the question of moral hazard appeared immediately.
Right.
So it's California-based, right? It was a lot of venture funds that had accounts there. And the questions started coming out, is their cash safe? Will they be able to access it? If so, when? You know, will they be able to make payroll? A lot of these smaller companies were very worried about payroll. And in California specifically, will the board of directors be liable if they couldn't make payroll? And then they started rolling it out to what about all the similarly situated banks? So we all know that by Monday morning, the contagion risk was too high and the government did step in. But the opportunities really arose from that. And so the first opportunity, which is very similar to doing regulatory capital investments with large banks, is being a risk capital provider to the small and regional banks. And I think we're going to see more and more of this over time. It's credit firms partnering with banks where we have access to all the diligence around their customers. And together we can jointly underwrite and make loans.
You mentioned moral hazard. Where was the moral hazard with Silicon Valley Bank? Was it the equity investors in the bank or was it the customers with, you know, way over the FDIC limits? And if there isn't a $250,000 or $500,000 ceiling, Did the Federal Reserve essentially say, okay, FDIC insurance is now unlimited? Is that the moral hazard?
We found that to be the moral hazard. Who's the governor of how much risk a bank can take? So the federal government came out and they said you have a $250,000 limit, but people were putting in $100 million into the account because they got 25 basis points more of interest, right? So how do you actually control that? That's the moral hazard we saw. Now, I think at the end of the day, it was just too big of a risk to the economy.
The contagion risk was, hey, there's a moral hazard question to the depositors, but rather than stand on ceremony, let's stop this before it spreads.
That's exactly right.
Huh. That's really kind of intriguing. What else has been the result of this rapid spike in interest rates? What do you see in the private credit world that, hey, blame the Fed, but here's what's gone off the rails?
Yeah, for credit investors, everyone thinks about fixed rate risk, right? But that's easily hedgeable, and that's a choice that credit investors make. So for people like Magnetar, we swap everything back to floating rate. We don't have any edge on a macro risk like that. But the second order effect is much, much more difficult, and that's the business impact of rates changing. So when we think about businesses, we think about, do profit margins change as rates go up or down? Do originations change? What about the refinancing of their debt? I think those are the things that are going to keep lawyers and restructuring advisors very busy for the foreseeable future.
So given this current environment where, first, rates went up further and faster than it seemed like the consensus amongst analysts was, they stayed higher longer than people expected. There's no recession. People have been talking about that for 2 years. And the expected rate cuts, I guess, tied to that recession, haven't showed up yet. We were talking about March. Now we're talking about May, even June of 2024. How does this affect how you think about putting portfolios together, constructing portfolios? And I am very aware that you guys aren't macro tourists. You don't play that game. But given the volatility and the various probabilistic outcomes, how does that impact your thinking?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And for us, we think a lot about the affordability factor. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you two examples at both extremes. So we have a partial ownership in an auto loan business in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And so when rates are at zero, we're loaning to consumers at somewhere between 5.5% and 6%, and we're gaining market share rapidly. All of a sudden, risk-free rate goes to 5%. That equivalent loan, we're going to have to charge consumers 11%. It's simply unaffordable.
Right. Different calculus, for sure.
Different calculus. And so we have a decision to make. We can stay at 11%, keep the same margin, but reduce our origination, or we can take our margin down and try to keep market share. Either way, the business is worth a lot less.
Right.
That has a lot of affordability factor effect to it. On the other end of the stream is our music royalties business. So in music royalties, you know, the simplification is you get some small part of worldwide streaming revenue, right? So take Spotify. Spotify raised rates recently, and they had no customer churn. So some percentage of that rate went directly to the royalty holder. Mm-hmm. There was very little affordability factor. So we're veering away from things that the business impact on affordability is high, and we're investing in things where it's lower.
Private credit seems to be getting a lot of attention these days. Why is that?
If you would have asked me going into the global financial crisis, I know we keep going back 15 years now, I would have said the banks had it all, right? They controlled origination of all of the different asset classes, especially finance and lending. So whether it was credit cards or mortgages or loans to their customers. But as the financial crisis happened, there was a spotlight flashed on their balance sheet. They just had too much risk. Mm-hmm. And so the regulators came in to reduce that risk. So the simple question is that private credit came in and stepped in the shoes of banks and really took market share. But this scale was much larger than anyone could have anticipated. But for me, what I think about a lot is the more profound effect is the talent transfer. The talent transfer from the banks that went to the credit providers, the private credit providers, that set the stage for this mass, you know, growth in private credit.
So let's talk about talent a little bit. One of the things I know your firm is proud of is more than half of your workforce has been with the firm for 5 years or longer. So first, I'm assuming that's not typical in your space. And second, I have to ask, what contributed to that sort of retention?
Yeah, I'm very proud, and I think we're very proud of that fact, and I think it is very atypical. But the credit really goes to so many people at Magnetar. You know, we're a global firm, but I think we're the Midwestern ethos. Mm-hmm. So it's work hard, stay humble, be a good teammate, be a good person. And I think if we can consistently demonstrate those qualities, we'll attract people who value them, and it's a virtuous circle. And what's incredible about the firm is when we're focused, how much we can get done. So I'll give you a simple example. We started a summer internship program several years ago, and we started with two interns, and we built the program around them. And this last summer, we had 60 interns for a 200-person organization. You know, it's pretty humbling when you think about all the exceptional people around Magnetar and how much we can get done.
So one of the things we've been hearing a lot about as big companies try and get their staff back in the office 5 days a week is corporate culture. Tell us a little bit about what is differentiating Magnetar from a cultural perspective. You know, starting with Evanston, Illinois, not a lot of private credit shops in the neighborhood.
That's true. You know, first principles, it's always about integrity. But I think for most tenured firms, integrity is high. But for us, the North Star is always creating the best portfolios to deliver to our clients. And we really have two foundational points there. One is we run a very flat organization. And secondly, we've thought a lot about alignment. So on the flat organization, it doesn't matter who has the right answer. We know we're trying to reach the right answer. So I'll take our investment committees as an example. We have biweekly investment committees, and it's not the top two or three people that sit on the investment committee. We have 120 people in that meeting, you know, every 2 weeks.
Wow.
And we really want people to voice opinions, right? And that's how we're going to get to the best answer. You know, we talk about it internally a lot. We're trying to manage investments by consensus. And so, especially in private credit, if someone doesn't like something, we can change it. We can change, you know, what a structure looks like. And so we'll get to something that where we actually get consensus. You know, on the alignment point, it really goes back to not giving individual capital allocations, but incentivizing people to create the best portfolio. So you asked about retention before. I think the reason why people stay at Magnetar long term is because they believe in these philosophies, and they believe if we get to the right portfolio, that everyone wins in the long term.
Huh, really very interesting.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So we only have you for a limited amount of time. Let me jump to my favorite questions that I ask all of my guests, starting with, tell us what you've been streaming these days. What's been keeping you entertained, either video or audio, Netflix or podcast? What's keeping you entertained?
Yeah, I think this will be different than most of the people that sit on this show, but for me, it's been Flow Sports.
Flow Sports.
Flow Sports. So I have, my older son is in between high school and college right now, mm-hmm. and he's playing hockey in juniors for a year. And so all of his games are on Flow Sports. So Christy and my son Jake and I sit around and watch every game together.
What position does he play?
He plays defense. Huh. It's been a lot of fun.
Flow Sports, is that like a YouTube channel, an internet channel? How do you find that?
We pull it up on Apple TV or on our phone, and yeah, it's been great for a lot of youth sports.
Huh, interesting.
And then on the podcast side, this podcast aside, obviously.
You never have to bring this podcast up.
Of course. So I listened to one by Larry Bernstein, What Happens Next, and he's been doing it since COVID, and it's sort of 6 minutes of, you know, really relevant topics that come out every weekend.
What Happens Next? I'm going to check that out. I love the idea of these, having done long form for a decade, I love the idea of 5, 10, 12 minutes, and you're done, and there's something very appealing about that. Let's talk about your mentors who helped to shape your career.
You know, it always starts with their parents and then, you know, football coaches like Larry Kimbaum. But I mentioned Dave Bunning before. I think most people would say, you know, I'm a product of his teachings over time.
Huh. Interesting. How about books? What are some of your favorites? What are you reading right now?
You know, I always like Michael Lewis books. We had him at one of our offsites a few years ago. You may remember this book as one of my favorites, you know, Memos from the Chairman by Alan Greenberg.
Sure.
That was a great book.
Ace Greenberg, right?
Ace Greenberg.
From Bear Stearns.
Correct. And what was so interesting about his book is, you know, he's running the firm, but he's really in the minutiae of every detail. It was very interesting.
Including the paper clips, recycling the paper clips.
Every expense.
So let me interrupt you one sec and say, I was at a lunch just with, you know, three people at a table, and he came in and sat like a table or two over. And the whole meal, I mean, this was later in his life, the whole meal was a parade of people coming in to genuflect in front of him and just pay their respects. It was like the Pope was having lunch. I don't know how well you know of him, and the book certainly is kind of, you know, you don't get a sense of how other people perceived him, but fascinating guy.
I met him when he was at Bear Stearns, and I felt the same way. He was a special person.
What other books are you reading? Anything else you want to mention?
So my colleague and the head of our London office, Alan Shaffron, recommended the book, The Missing Billionaires. Mm-hmm. And the reason I just started, but the reason it's interesting is it's very focused on asset allocation and mistakes in asset allocation and how much that can cost a portfolio over time. So it has a lot of parallels to the way we think about asset allocation at Magnetar.
Huh. Really interesting. Our final two questions. What sort of advice would you give a recent college grad interested in the career in either private credit, alts, fixed income, any of the areas you specialized in?
It's what we think about for the firm. And I know what I tell my kids would be, it's people and platform. You need to be around good, integrous people that are great mentors. And the platform needs to be growing over time. So each seat should be worth more than the person in it.
Huh, interesting. And our final question, what do you know about the world of investing, of credit, of risk management today that you wish you knew when you were first getting started 30 years or so ago?
Yeah, this may be an atypical answer, but I think about luck versus skill a lot more than I ever did before. If you make a decision today and don't have an outcome for 10 years, you don't really know if you were good at it or not, right? Whether you won or lost. If you're able to have a much faster feedback loop, now you can really hone your skills and understand whether you're making, you know, good decisions or bad decisions. And so I think for me, and as we look at people's track records, we really try to think about how often do they get to make the same decision, and what's the process around that decision, and how different is it over time?
Very, very interesting. I have a book for you, but I'm going to bet you've already read it. Michael Mobison's book.
I have not. Please.
Separating Skill from Luck in Investing, Business, and Sports. Like, that is right up your alley.
That is. Thank you.
And he's a fascinating author and really a fascinating book. I would bet you would appreciate it.
Excellent.
Thank you, David, for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with David Snyderman. He is the global head of alternative credit and fixed income and managing partner at Magnetar, a $15 billion multi-strategy, multi-product alternative investment management firm. If you enjoy this conversation, well, check out any of the previous 500 or so we've had. You can find those at iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, Bloomberg, wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Be sure and check out my new podcast, At the Money, 10 minutes each week with an expert discussing a topic that's relevant to you and your money. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps me put these conversations together each week. Sarah Livesey is my audio engineer. Atika Valbrun is my project manager. Anna Luke is my producer. Sean Russo is my head of research. Sage Bauman is our head of podcasts. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.